This is Business of Home. I'm Dennis Scully, and welcome to the Thursday Show. Later on, I'll be speaking with Leanne Ford about her new book. But first, we're going to catch up on the news, including change at the top at MillerKnoll, how the AI boom is shaking up San Francisco's housing market, and a surprising new luxury amenity. To do all that, I'm joined by Business of Home's executive editor, Fred Nikolaos. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Dennis. How's it going?
Great. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm scared. I really want to do an English accent right now, but once I get you started on that, because you're
don't
in London right now, and I know we'll never get out of it. But how is London town? How's it treating you?
Well, Fred, it's pretty hard for me not to slip right into it, as you know. But London is great, and I'm thrilled to be here.
And you're not just there to take in Arsenal's Premier League victory, which I'm sure all our listeners care about. You're there for Wow House. What's it all about? Tell the people.
Wow House is so much fun. You know, they don't have show houses here in the UK, and so they have to build one inside the Chelsea Harbour Design Centre, and it's this massive 6,500 square foot show house with 22 different rooms and outdoor spaces, and it is literally built inside of this long stretch of hallway in the design centre, and it is spectacular. There are a whole array of designers who come in and partner with brands and turn out these incredible rooms. Friend of the show, Young Ha, did an amazing room with Benjamin Moore. Sarah Cosgrove partnered with Philip Jeffries. Our guest this week on the show, Max Rollett, partnered with Schumacher and did an incredible room. There's just a whole array of talent on display here. And it's literally all just built for the month. And then they have 5 days to outfit the room and put it all together. It's a remarkable feat.
Well, I'm glad they've taken over the tradition of incredible stress around a show house from America. You know, that's an important aspect of the experience. Yeah, I love the fact that it's just built inside a design center. We should start doing like model homes in ADAC or something like that in the atrium there. Anyway, very cool. Follow Dennis on Instagram for some great pictures from the show. And speaking, as you mentioned, Max Rollett was your guest on Monday's episode of the show. I know you've just seen him in person and you've been to see his barn. Why don't you talk a little bit about what Max Rollett is up to?
Talk about a multifaceted guy. So Max came up as a furniture restorer and is an antiques dealer and now does an array of bespoke furniture as well. And of course, also has a design business. So went out to his barn in the countryside where you can witness the whole operation. He said in his interview on the show, which I thought was so dear, that the antiques around him his whole life have given him so much joy, and he wanted to sort of give back in that way. And so that's how he feels about being surrounded by antique furniture. It's just all the stories and the history of all of those pieces can't help but make you feel joyful. And I love that notion. What did you think of my chat with Max?
Well, he's such a talented guy. And it's funny because in classic English fashion, he really downplays it. You know, it's very much,
yes,
oh, you know, I like to restore furniture. And then you look at the website, like, oh, this is incredible, this operation he has there. So I don't know. I'm always interested in the various ways that people get into interior design. You know, there's a lot of people who come from hospitality and there's people who come, you know, from real estate. It's really interesting to see someone who came up as an antique restorer. And I just love kind of hearing how that gives him an interesting insight onto the business. His work is incredible. So yeah, definitely a fun conversation to check out.
And definitely worth the trip for the designers who come over to the UK. It might not be something that you immediately think of, but you will not be disappointed if you make a trip out to Max's barn. And I hope that many people will make it over for Wow House. It runs for about a month now, and it's always worth a visit. So I know many people DM me that they're coming in the coming weeks, and so I hope everyone gets to enjoy it. Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we'll get into the news. This episode is sponsored by Leloy, a family-run company known for thoughtfully designed rugs, pillows, and wall art, and for building lasting partnerships across the design industry. In a market saturated with options, Leloy stands apart through a point of view that feels both elevated and enduring, offering handcrafted and machine-made collections that balance artistry, texture, and timeless design. Their assortment is designed to work across a wide range of interiors, giving designers the flexibility to create spaces that feel personal, layered, and lasting. And with a deep in-stock inventory, ready for the busy summer project season, Leloy helps designers move quickly without compromising on style or quality. To explore the collection or connect with a sales rep, visit leloyrugs.com. That's L-O-L-O-I, rugs.com. This podcast is sponsored by Newport Brass. Since 1989, Newport Brass has handcrafted solid brass kitchen and bath fixtures in California, blending timeless design with exceptional craftsmanship. With complete collections spanning traditional to modern and 22 finish options available across every product, Newport Brass offers designers and homeowners the freedom to create spaces that feel distinctly personal. Every piece is thoughtfully engineered to feel substantial in the hand, beautiful in the home, and built to last for generations. Explore the full portfolio at newportbrass.com and discover craftsmanship that stands the test of time. And we're back. First up, Fred, big news out of MillerKnoll.
Indeed. Earlier this week, the company announced that its president and CEO, Andy Owen, had stepped down. Or did she step down? That's the question here.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously we don't have any inside insight into exactly what happened here, but the optics around this, you know, it was announced that she was retiring, but that she was, you know, beginning an effective, an immediate leave of absence, effective immediately, suggests that she was kind of, you know, shown the door. I don't know. This is pretty big news. Is this a surprise? Has this been a long time coming? What's your read on this?
I think the bigger surprise is that this didn't happen earlier. And I think when you talk to a lot of people, both within the organization and people outside of the organization who have been involved in one way or another, I think they're surprised that Andy's tenure lasted as long as it did. And I think we can get into some of the specifics of what's happened to the company over the years and sort of try to get an understanding as to what really did happen during her leadership.
Well, you know, she took over in 2018. She came from The Gap. So she was from this outsider, like not someone from the design industry, but someone who had a lot of retail experience. And so I think the thought at the time was that she was going to bring in this, you know, retail energy and transform that side of her, at that time, Herman Miller's business. But then she oversaw this incredibly big merger, you know, the joining of Herman Miller and Knoll to create this new company, MillerKnoll, which I think is in some ways undercovered. It's like, I think the biggest design industry merger ever. It was this enormous deal. And I think that largely is what her tenure at the top will be, you know, defined by, is the bringing together of these two giant entities and whether it went well or didn't. History will be able to judge in the long term, but in the short term, it's definitely been fairly rocky, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if you look at how the stock market has responded to it, both when the news first came out, when the news first broke, the shares of Knoll skyrocketed and the shares of Herman Miller, as you say, at the time fell rather sharply. And I think that was an early indication of some wariness around this deal. And that has somewhat been proven out because Knoll was acquired for about $1.8 billion at the time. And if you look at the market capitalization today, a MillerKnoll, it is $1 billion. So yeah. Somewhere. Yeah. And at the time, they thought this was going to be a $3 billion plus deal. And there were all sorts of synergies and value to be unlocked. And often people get very carried away when a big deal is announced. But even if you took out all of that, it's still pretty shocking to see that the market cap is all the way down to $1 billion from a $1.8 billion purchase of Knoll.
Yeah, and they also took on a huge amount of debt to do it. There's still, I think, over $1 billion on their books that they're still servicing. Now, I mean, we should say that, like, you know, she took over at the beginning of what has been probably the most tumultuous time ever in the home industry. I mean, like, clearly the stock hasn't done what everyone wanted it to do, but you know, she was dealing with COVID and then the aftermath of COVID and then the tariffs and then all the conflict in the Middle East and inflation. I mean, it's been the most eventful time for any leader in this industry. So how she's judged in the long term has to be seen in that light. But I don't know. There was also the whole pity city thing. Should we dredge up that gem, Dennis? Or?
I think you should remind people about pity city. Yeah. Because again, after pity city, many people thought, well, this is it. She's gone. So go ahead.
Yeah. So this was in 2023. There was a town hall meeting that she was presiding over, a virtual town hall meeting. And some employees asked about their bonus. And she said something along the lines of, leave pity city, you know, go out there and get the money. It was sort of just kind of, I don't want to see if she was telling these employees off, but it was a bit of like a harsh reaction to someone asking about their bonus. Now, that in itself might have been nothing much, but it was leaked. It became a viral moment. It was covered by NPR and CNN. It became a whole cultural moment about how, you know, people are pushing back against their bosses. And I think there was a lot of, you know, she took a lot of heat at the time. She later apologized for the comments. You know, whether that was just one small moment that was blown out of proportion by the virality machine that is the modern day internet, I don't know. But it certainly cast a pallor over her leadership. And like, I saw a lot of commentary, you know, even now, the stories about her stepping down or leaving, several of the headlines were like, the person who said pity city is out. And there's a lot of schadenfreude around it. You know, I don't know inside the company if people feel that way, but certainly it was, you know, a moment that she'll be associated with.
Yeah. And as you say, she faced incredible challenges. So this was a huge office furniture giant. And we all know the challenges that coming back to the office has faced over the years, and it hasn't returned as quickly as many people imagined, and certainly they had hoped. But there were a lot of challenges with bringing those dealer networks together. I think there was a lot of criticism about how all of that was handled. I think that there was just a lot of criticism around how the development of the many brands that came to the company as a result of the Knoll acquisition, including, as we talked about recently, Holly Hunt, which clearly has faced many challenges, and we saw them have to write down a lot of the goodwill, a lot of the value beyond just the assets of that company needed to be written down because business was clearly underperforming, and they've had a big management turnover there. So I think a lot of things just didn't work out the way everybody had hoped, as you said earlier, and there were any number of challenges. Also interesting that there clearly wasn't a succession plan in place.
Yeah.
So she's out. Know. And there's nobody who is stepping up. Obviously, they have the interim, the COO is stepping in, and he's been with the company for a long time. But interesting that they also didn't have that in place, which I think, again, to many is telling of what this organizational structure was like.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, the news peg to some degree is that their most recent earnings report was, I don't want to say it was a disaster, but it certainly was not received well by the market. Maybe that has to do with the timing here. But yeah, it's absolutely right. This reads as abrupt. I'm really curious to see who takes over. You know, this is, despite all the troubles we've just been talking about for the past 10 minutes, this is an iconic company. It's huge. Think of all the brands that are under this portfolio. It's Herman Miller, it's Knoll, it's Maharam, it's Holly Hunt, it's Hay, it's Muto, it's all these, you know, really cool brands. And I would love to see somebody come in with fresh ideas, because these are great brands and great companies. And this is like, this is the biggest American design company there is, really, when you get right down to it. So I'd love to see a real interesting hire. So we'll definitely talk about that when it happens.
I agree. And, you know, hearing this news, I went back, Fred, and actually read the piece that you wrote at the time of the acquisition. And interestingly enough, many people have been concerned about the possible retail direction that some of these great brands might take. There was a quote from Holly Hunt in your article at the time saying that, truthfully, if they were smart, they might figure out a way to do more Holly Hunt in a retail direction. So, I think we'll have to see how all of this plays out and the decisions that get made. But what's poignant is that the stock has fallen even further on the announcement of the ouster of the CEO. And often when you see a leadership change, there's a big rally in the stock saying, oh, okay, fresh blood's going to come in and make things better. But the stock continues to fall after the news, which I think is a message that the market is really quite concerned about this situation. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of these great assets are quickly spun off or other big news comes in addition to who the next leader is. But I think we'll be talking about this a lot in the future. And as you say, there are some tremendous to the trade brands contained within there. And I hope that things work out well for all of it. We have to move on and talk about family compounds. This week, BOH's Jen Fernandez wrote about a recent rise in multi-generational living, Fred.
How's your family compound coming along, Dennis? Are you got it? You got it going in Bronxville there?
I wish I had a family compound, Fred. We'll get into it, but I mean, I would love for all my kids to come and live nearby, and I'm going to talk about that with them when we get off this recording.
Well, my kids currently live very nearby, so we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. Yeah, Jen wrote a great piece for the site businessofhome.com about family compounds. And I sort of feel like I've been hearing chatter in the industry about how this is more and more of a thing. You know, this designer has a cool family compound project and, you know, in Long Island, and this person has this project over there. It's kind of like a genre of project that I'm hearing about more and more. Obviously, as Jen points out in the piece, there's a range. You know, we say family compound, you know, you think of Kennebunkport or something. It could just be a relatively small lot with a couple buildings on it. But some of these are very ambitious projects. They have like one of them has like a bowling alley on it. Like there's all kinds of amenities. And it's just, you know, it's just basically a large group of residences all owned by one family for people to gather. And it's kind of crazy. Have you heard this as well, Dennis? Is this coming up on your radar too?
It's come up a lot in conversation. And it's funny, somebody said to me recently, if I build it, will they come? And they were talking about, you know, if I do build this great big family compound, and to your point, if I make a great big pool area and a playroom, and like, what do I need to do to entice my kids to bring the grandkids along and come and live nearby? And I think that there's just been such massive wealth creation, sort of a theme throughout our show, perhaps. But there's just this ability to think on this kind of scale for so many people today. And a family compound is an option suddenly for so many. And it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is sort of downstream of like the wealth concentration around the baby boomer generation, right? It's like, I always feel like we kind of want to say, oh, it's turning over to millennials now and they have all the money. Not really. Like boomers still have most of the money in America. And you think about somebody who's getting into their 70s and even 80s, they have a ton of money. What do they want to spend it on? They don't want to buy a random, you know, nice watch. They want to be with their family, you know? And what's a great way to be with your family? Build them a compound, you know? And I think because there is so much wealth concentration, and because, you know, the more people see that, oh, this other person is doing it, the more it becomes kind of a, I don't want to call it a trend, but a trendlet within the industry, and you're seeing more and more of them. I also think there's sort of a COVID angle to this as well. Jen explored that in her piece. I think there was a sense of people, I don't know, the world feeling a little more unsafe and wanting to kind of gather your brood around you, wanting to build your own little world kind of apart from the, you know, the dangers of the big, bad real world. So I think it's kind of a combination of those two things is creating these projects. Whether you can get one is another story, but they are certainly a great project if you can.
Well, I think it's such a great point. And the COVID tie-in, I remember during COVID, you and I would talk to so many people who were having these elaborate dining tables built so that because they had all their family staying with them at the time. And I wonder if for many people that planted the seed of, yeah, it was really great when all the kids were here. Sure, they were forced to be here and they couldn't leave because of COVID restrictions. Maybe we can get them back by enticing them with all of these other offerings. But I do think people got a taste of what that was like. I also think that this whole issue of sort of family planning and sort of long-term strategy also sort of enters into all of this. And it seems like for many, it just is a reasonable way to think about estate management and other operations that are happening around the family's long-term thinking.
Yeah, I definitely think there were lessons learned from COVID. And also there was like, let's have separate buildings. I think there was a lot of like families joining together in one space and kind of enjoying it on one level, but also let's have your own house, you know? But yeah. I mean, I think when I think about what this really means for designers, it's kind of tricky because I would obviously love to say like, hey, get a family compound project, but they don't, you know, they're not hanging low from the trees. This is something that obviously only the very wealthy can afford. And I think that's a small number of people. And certainly I think if you're a designer and you know your client wants a family compound, you already know that and you don't don't need Fred and Dennis to tell you. But what I will say, what this kind of reminds me of is what a long-term industry this really is. You know, if you stick to one family, you build up a great relationship, you do the dorm room for the college kid, you don't make any money, that's going to pay off down the road, or it certainly can pay off down the road. And it's just, this is not an industry for short-term thinking. I think most people know that, but this kind of thing really drives that home.
I completely agree. And also, you know, we talk so often about staying in touch with people and managing those relationships. So many designers share with me their elaborate Christmas lists that they have for all their clients and their clients' families and all of that. And I think those are all such great investments and such a great way to think about this, because many firms have been built on just a handful of families over the years that have gone on to multiply, and I just think this is a relationship business, and this story really drives home the opportunity in all of that. So I love this story, and again, I would love for my kids to come and live nearby. So let's make that happen in the future. Moving on, Fred, we got to talk about good old San Francisco.
We do. There, the AI boom has transformed the city's real estate landscape, which is now home to the highest median home price in the country. Crazy stuff. Dennis, what do you make of this story?
Well, I mean, so I feel like it's your hometown. The lovely Mrs. Scully grew up just outside of San Francisco and considers it home. And I wish we had her family home now, because, boy, it would sure be worth a lot. But it's remarkable to see. I was just there over the Christmas holidays, and all anybody was talking about was how expensive apartments were. Guess what? They're even more expensive now, just a few months later.
I know. It's kind of crazy. So I grew up in the Bay Area. I actually grew up in Oakland and Berkeley, and I was my plan was to go off to New York and make my fortune as an interior design journalist and come back and buy a nice, you know, cheap house in Oakland. And that's gone. You know, it's crazy how much, you know, real estate has changed there. There was a stat in an article in the Wall Street Journal about how the city's luxury zip code, sort of the 3.1 million to 8 million-ish, saw an average 13.4% increase over the past 2 years. And they pegged it directly to the debut of ChatGPT, because, of course, all of this is coming from the AI boom. Like, these are the companies that you know, it's not the Miller Knowles who are minting the billionaires. It's the investors in OpenAI, Anthropic, you know, Google. These are the companies that are seeing their valuations increase, and it's what's driving this crazy real estate boom.
Yeah, and so much more wealth is about to be unlocked, as we have the IPO for SpaceX and OpenAI and Anthropic, and billionaires galore, multimillionaires galore. I mean, it's a huge opportunity for this very specific market.
Yeah, I mean, just to break that down a little bit, you know, the big AI companies, OpenAI, the maker of ChatGPT, Anthropic, the maker of Claude, they're both planning to IPO in the immediate future, and also SpaceX, which is not explicitly a San Francisco company, but certainly has a lot of employees and investors in San Francisco. You know, they're all planning to, you know, debut on the stock market, and the valuations are in the hundreds of billions, if not the trillions, for these three companies. And so, you know, they may go well, they may not go well, but whatever happens, a lot of the employees who have stock, a lot of people who invested, are going to see a sudden windfall of cash. And I bet a lot of people in San Francisco in particular are thinking like, okay, well, is that cash going to turn into a home? And is that home going to turn into a project? And I imagine it will. It's interesting. You know, I San Francisco designers are sort of like, it's tough to get a read. I feel like I reached out to a couple of them recently, and they hadn't seen any crazy boom yet. I know you put something up on Instagram. It didn't seem like, maybe everyone was locked down by an NDA, Dennis, and they couldn't tell you what was coming their way. But I have to imagine some of that money is going to trickle down to our industry. And I think that's a good side of this.
Well, exactly. I want to be optimistic about that as well, that much of this money will come to the design industry. I think there's already been a huge wealth creation just from the run-up in the valuation of many of these stocks that are in the AI space, the ones that are already public. But I think that, as you say, the wealth creation will only continue. Whether or not the level of design that we often talk about here on the show matters as much to this group is part of what we'll discover. But I certainly hope that it's good for San Francisco designers.
Yeah, I wonder if Sam Altman knows who Billy Baldwin is. It's a funny idea. Yeah, I mean that's you know a question that we've talked about is you know what kind of design do these people invest in? But they do have homes. They put things in their homes, and so I'm hopeful that some of this money will trickle down. You know, I think the kind of dark side of this story is just that it really does add to the income inequality story that we talk about a lot on the show. Is just that, you know, the rich are getting richer. It's the K-shaped economy is very real. And though, you know, these IPOs will mint a lot of millionaires, it's not a large group of people. And this will certainly like benefit, you know, only or pretty much mainly the luxury zip codes in San Francisco, whereas I feel like it'll make it harder for everyday 100,000-aires and low-key millionaires to find a spot. So that's an angle of the story as well. But, you know, we're going to try and see the positive and hope that that AI money turns into fabric. that's my hope anyway.
Well, and I know that many designers are concerned about AI coming for the design world in some way. So the irony of rooting for this massive wealth
right,
creation coming from this industry is also a little, as I say, it's a little ironic to be rooting for that. I am rooting for Business of Home coming public and the huge fortune thread that will come our way when that happens one day. Can't wait for
I'm gonna spend it all on fabric when that happens. So don't worry.
Exactly.
Don't
worry. Exactly. Moving on, we're going to talk about wellness. For the Wall Street Journal this week, Peter Grant explored why one luxury condo building in New York will soon house a high-end longevity clinic. I love this story on so many levels, Fred, that I just can't wait to discuss it. And I feel like I need to go for an MRI right now.
Well, it's not just an MRI. It's genetic testing. It's whatever biomarker monitoring is. It's whole body scans. It's a whole thing, this like longevity industry. And this is a great story about how that's kind of crossing over with the residential real estate world. You know, it's a luxury condo building, as you mentioned, and they had some office space in the whole complex. And, you know, they could have given it to some random tech company, or they could have given it to Business of Home or whatever. But they thought, okay, we're going to get this longevity business in here because the kind of tenant who's going to be in our building probably wants to get this whole body scan. It's really become a trend among not just the regular affluent but the super affluent. It's a thing.
It is a thing, and it's funny that not too long ago we were talking about aging in place and why isn't that coming up more in the conversation? And we were talking about just making grab bars look better, and that seems like such a minor
so quaint
story relative to, wait a sec, what they really want is entire structures that are all about healthcare being nearby.
Yeah, it's funny, right? It's never framed as like healthcare exactly. It's a longevity clinic.
Yes, I love the reframing.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and this has been kind of like, it's been an obsession of the wealthy. And I think it only makes sense, right? It's like you've bought everything money can buy. Now let's live forever, or at least, you know, live another 20 years. And I think that, you know, that's always kind of been a thing, as Peter Grant points out in the story. But because there's so much more technology now, because it's much more in the culture, I think that people are exploring new ways to kind of get obsessed over living longer and living healthier. And, you know, I don't know, there are dumber things to spend money on, certainly. There are 350 of these clinics all over the world, as the story says, but only a few of them are sort of combined with residential projects, less than 20. I think that number is going to go radically up. I feel like there's going to be a lot of demand for designers who understand what genetic screening is and what advanced heart imaging means, and maybe not incorporating that into everybody's home, but certainly into, you know, bigger residential projects. You know, you get the family compound, you get the MRI center in your family compound, you're in great shape. But I do think, look, it's a little silly. And part of me always, you know, worries when we talk about this issue that this is fueling people's hypochondria. And how, you know, is this all real science? I don't know necessarily, but I think there's certainly worse things to spend money on. And I think designers who can figure out a way to incorporate it into their business are going to stand to benefit. So this, you know, that number, 20 longevity clinics combined with residential projects, is, I think we talk about that in 6 months, it's going to be double that.
I completely agree. And I think there's a huge opportunity to make these places look and feel great. And I think that's the opportunity for designers. I also think, going back to our earlier conversation in the show, this is another reason to invest in these long-term relationships. So take advantage of that and be their best friend in all of this is the opportunity for designers. And I think this is a story that's not going away. All right, that's it for the news, but there's plenty more to check out on businessofhome.com, including a roundup of the latest industry hires and 8 lessons for designers who are growing their firms. But first, a quick break. Newport Brass is renowned for its exquisitely crafted solid brass faucets and fixtures. Continuing its legacy of creating designs that feel both relevant and timeless, Newport Brass has unveiled 2 new collections this year, Kimball Bath and Party's Kitchen, each rooted in craftsmanship. Formed and finished in-house in Southern California, both collections reflect the brand's enduring commitment to material integrity, precision, and lasting design. With complete kitchen and bath suites, from faucets and fittings to accessories, available across all 22 finishes, Newport Brass gives designers the freedom to realize a fully considered vision without compromise. Visit newportbrass.com/new to explore the latest collections. Leloy continues to invest in the practical side of the design business, with dedicated sales reps, multiple showrooms, and a streamlined website designed to make sourcing easier when timelines are tight and projects are moving fast. With a broad in-stock assortment available throughout the busy summer design season, Leloy helps designers find the right pieces quickly and confidently. You can browse collections, connect with a sales rep, or find the showroom nearest you at leloyrugs.com. And we're back. I'm joined now by interior designer Leanne Ford. Leanne, welcome back to the show.
Yay. Hi, Dennis. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to have you. I'm so eager to catch up, and I'm longing to discuss your new book, Feel Free Home.
You know it.
Which will have dropped by the time this show airs. So congratulations on that. And let's get right to it. What's the book all about?
You know, Feel Free Home is my second book. I have one out called The Slow Down. And that was about my Pennsylvania home and project and everything involving that. And Feel Free Home is a bit of a retrospective, if I'm allowed to say that, at 40 something.
Leanne's already looking back on the life
like,
she's
I'm
had.
Good. Yeah, let's yeah. call it. And it's kind of all my favorites from all my projects, but it is inspiring the reader to feel free as they create. So for me, interior design is such an art form first, and it's not a, to me, it's not a CAD drawing. It is full art and it's subjective. So I kind of walk through how I look at projects and the art of it. Things that add soul to your home, basically. So vintage, personality, music, nature and texture. So thinking about those specific categories and how you can bring those into every home and project and space.
Love it. And I want to talk more about it, but you started off by saying that in her previous book, The Slowdown, it was all about this house in Pennsylvania. And you explained to me last time you were on the show about this wonderful new life that you were having in Pennsylvania. And then wait a sec, you're no longer there.
What? We are still in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
Or like I start crying. We are still in Pennsylvania. Right. I'm absolutely in love with our little town called Sewickley in Pennsylvania. And I've had a residence there since 2010, actually. Okay. And I will continue to. But we had to come back to California. My husband has a business called Buck Mason, and they're based here.
Yes.
So in efforts to, you know, keep the family unit together, be a good wifey. Okay. But I'm a country girl, so I always will probably keep residence in Pennsylvania in some sort.
Well, it certainly sounded as if the slowdown life was agreeing with you.
I love the slowdown. Well, you know, my family kind of teases me because they're like, Leanne, if this is the slowdown, like I'd like to see you, because I'm still doing 14,000 things, but kind of all with a lot of peace of mind and relaxing and enjoying the joy of the creation, which is truly why I do what I do. I love creating most in all forms. And it's been really fun to just continue that. And that's what Feel Free Home is mainly about, like the love of creating and giving people permission. I got to say, like, this is not perfect. It will not be perfect. You know, houses are wonky. They're like living, breathing things. So they're wonky. And how do you go with that, enjoy that, and work with it?
And one of the things that you get into, and I'm so glad that you said that, because one of the things that you you talk about make more mistakes, and there's a there's a wonderful framed sort of quote from Bob Dylan in the book that sort of refers to the best lessons you ever learned was sort of through mistakes. But I want to talk about that more, because I think sometimes people are not uptight, but they're worried about making mistakes, and you want to give them permission.
100%. I mean, I would say in every field, you know, that's kind of, especially a creative field, let's say, is you have to be ready to try things. They don't work, you fix it. You know, for us, we're very lucky. It's like, oh, I got to repaint. That is not the right color. And that's kind of the worst of it in reality. But creatively and artistically, you have to push it. And if you want to get to something special, I always say, if you're not making anyone nervous, you're not doing anything special. And that includes yourself. I mean, even though I'm like very loose with like, oh, let's try this. Oh, didn't work. No problem. There's still points you're like, ooh, what am I doing? You know? And it just is. Design is such a fluid, you know, I always leave room to create on the fly, which can be like a contractor's nightmare. Like I cannot do it on CAD and then be like, okay, we're good. This is what the house is going to be. I really have to say like, all right, let's open up the walls and then we'll see. And then we'll see and like kind of do it piecemeal really. But that's when the good stuff happens, in my opinion.
It's funny. There was a whole series of fun Instagram videos about the contractor saying, no, you can't do why you're doing this and why you're doing that. And I so thought of you and I thought, oh.
Dennis, so did everybody else. Everybody said that to me. The contractor's like, can't do that. Like, yes, you can.
Why are we opening up that wall? Why are we putting that here? And I thought, yeah, no, Leanne Ford is. She's making you. And you're going to be so much happier on the other side.
You know what? You got to get used to the eye roll. Like, anybody I give advice to in design, I'm like, you are going to ask your contractor to do this. They are going to roll their eyes. They're going to say, I've never done that. They're going to say, you can't do that. And you say, yes, we can. Let's try it. Like, you just have to be okay with the eye roll.
I think that's another great lesson, is you just have to get used to the eye roll. That is so true. And often like the knee jerk reaction is no, right? Because it means more time or it means more labor or it means, right? They got to stop what they're doing. And so they want to say no right away to see if they can just shut you down, right?
That's right. And you know, I usually like, it seems to me the pattern is no, and then they sleep on it. And then the next day they're like, okay, I figured it out, you know, but it takes a special person to work with us creative design types, you know, we are not easy, but it's like, you know, it's cute. My contractor now, his name's David. I'll present an idea. He'll be like, ooh, goosebumps. And I'm like, thank you, David, for that.
Oh, okay.
Very supportive.
Yeah. All right.
Poor guy.
So he's getting into it. So last time we were talking, we talked about you calling yourself rather a designer of interiors versus an interior designer. how are you feeling about that today?
I probably made that up while talking to you, by the
way. Exactly.
I'm sure of it.
That's what I figured.
No, I think I'm just a designer. I've loved writing. I'm writing a lot more. I love words. Words is kind of my favorite art form, ironically, and being able to play with that more where it doesn't involve a plumber and the permit office. And like that feels nice right now a little bit. But no, just still cranking out all the art forms, man. Love them all.
Well, I love hearing that. And it sounds like you've got a whole bunch of collections that you're working on and you're drinking out of your own mug at this very moment. I mean, right?
So. Yes, that is real. Yeah, I really am loving creating for the love of creation, which is like a great joy to be able to do. I feel like I'm at that point in my career where I can play even more. So I did my own tabletop collection, which is at leanneford.com. It's called Terra Firma. I did everything out in Portugal. And then I love, love, love doing these partnerships. So I have my second line coming out, Laloy, which has been a great joy. I'm still cruising at Crate and Barrel and Crate and Kids. So I really get to create for the love of it. I put it out on the planet, and how and where it lives is kind of out of my control, and I'm okay with that. I can kind of release from that part.
Well, and I'm curious, Leanne, how much you pay attention to trends that are going on in the home world, this whole collectible design movement, for example, which has gotten quite big, and lots of big auctions have gone down recently. And does that show up for you at all?
No. Does not show up for me at all. You know, every once in a while I see what's like happening in the zeitgeist and I'm like, oh, there you are. Welcome. You know, I mean, I think we love what we love, what we love, and like what happens within, you know, trend and things like that is it's like you feel seen and heard. Like, so that's a great thing. I just don't think it should change your path creatively.
I agree. And we touched on Buck Mason. You've been very involved in that brand and developed multiple stores. And I wonder, and we should tell people what Buck Mason is because it's a super fun brand if people don't know.
Yeah, you know, I can't take much credit. My husband, Eric Ford, who took my last name, thank you very much, and his partner, Sasha Cohen, started Buck Mason, which is a clothing brand, which is now for men and women. But I helped with them with their stores very early on. I helped with probably like 30 or more. And now they're such a beautiful, well-oiled machine.
Right.
They now have this coffee shop, Fast Times, which is in Nashville and New York and Abbot Kinney, where I have some of my stuff. So I have kind of a shop-in-shop, Leanne Ford in Buck Mason in Venice, and I get to kind of do my curated treasures and some of my handmade stuff and little fun trinkets.
Well, because I was curious what you were doing in retail. It seems like a really interesting time in retail, and that people are trying to figure out where is this all going, and who, right? And who are the great retailers that are hopefully going to come back and make retail sort of fun and exciting again in the home world?
Well, yeah. I mean, there's like hobbyist retail and then there's legit retail. I'm a hobbyist. I'm just going to admit it. And then Buck Mason's very much legit.
Right.
So I get to kind of tag along with that.
Well, it's nice to get to tag along with. I was wondering, you and I didn't get to speak at the time. Did Pantone reach out to you when they decided on Cloud White as their color? Did they go, Leanne, listen, we need to talk?
Did they ask me permission
exactly.
to use white?
Did you sign off on it? Or
you know what? Nobody from Pantone called me. But I will say everybody kind of congratulated me.
This was your moment. You've been telling them all along.
Yeah, they're like, congrats on white being the color. I was like, you guys, I've been telling you this for 10 years.
Leanne's like, yes, no, I've built a whole brand around it. Thank you very much.
Well, it's funny because I have to say, I am obsessed with all versions of white, but I really do love a warm white. I just need to tell the world that. Warm white. Like not an optic white.
Okay.
Like not a sterile white.
Not a sterile white. Okay.
Yeah.
Important. So do you think, so where does Cloud fall in that? Is Cloud?
Cloud's great.
Cloud's great?
Approved.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So they didn't ask your permission or give you a heads up, but you approve of it, and that's good. So I want to come back to the book, because one of the things that I'm curious about, Leanne, and you and I have talked about this in the past, Feel Free Home is this whole sort of a little bit of a how-to and giving people permission, right? And and what do you want to have come out of this? Where do you want this to take
you? You know, it's actually interesting. Yeah, the how-to, it really is, there's recipes. It's like how we do our floors, how we do our textured walls, how we do different tile things, different kind of weathering things. So I really want to just hand my secrets out, quite honestly. Like I, you know, have through a lot of trial and a whole lot of error, been able to play with and create some really fun spaces. And, you know, since my very first project, which is 20 years ago, I guess, if I'm
Let's
being
not
honest,
worry about the date, right?
Wild. Yeah. I mean, since my very first project, I've always shared my references, shared my secrets, shared where I got things, shared how I did it. And it's done me right. Like it's been a really beautiful blessing in my career. People, when I started out, said, you can't tell people where you got that, or, you know, then they're not going to get it from you, or they're going to be able to rip you off. And I was like, I want them to rip me off, you know, because truly, it will always uniquely become your own project. I mean, you can see a picture and verbatim steal it, but it will become its own by sake of what you do with it, what your kind of creative processes, where it goes, where it's living. So no two things are alike. And I like that. And I also am happy to say, this is what I do that works. And I don't need to share with you all the million things I did that didn't work, you know?
but know that they exist. Exactly.
Yeah, and that's right. Great.
And that's all part of the process. The other thing that I love, part of what your work does is it makes you feel a certain way. And often that is relaxed and healed a little bit. I think today is a super stressful world that we're living in, especially if you pay any kind of attention to the news, which more and more people are trying to do less, understandably. But I think your spaces just create this mood and almost this medicine that you give to people.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like your home should be better than your vacation. You know what I mean? Like it you should want to go home, and you should be in whatever your version of serenity and zen is. I think feeling is everything. It's funny. And even when I'm talking to contractors or my team, and they'll be like on site, I'll be like, how's it feel? Like, feels like it's not done yet. Like, but I want feeling first. You know, it's something that does not translate on a computer animated drawing, but really translates in person. And, you know, there's so many stunning, beautiful projects and homes and places that they feels cold and boring when you're actually sitting there. You don't need to sit in there for more than 5 minutes. And then there's like kind of places that maybe don't translate as much visually, but when you're in it, man, it feels good. You know, like a beautiful, dark, tiny restaurant with low lighting. Like if you actually look at it, nothing's necessarily special, but it feels special. And that's what I kind of try to translate through my work.
So again, Leanne, I'm going to come back to, aren't there clients who want to hire you and have you come and do a bunch of homes for them? And are you?
Yes,
are you?
There are.
I know there are.
And I say thank you, but no, thank you. And I got to tell you, man, like there is a client right now, or a would-be client, I guess. And it's so hard to say no because the house is so magical. But at the end of the day, like I feel happier to give my secrets away, pass the projects on, let other people do these things and kind of work on whatever I want to, however, whenever.
So what's it about? I mean, is it about that you don't want to commit yourself to something that you know is going to be a 3-4?
I love that you're digging into this. Okay, so for me, I never had a firm because my expression in creating is so singular. Like I would rather kind of try, which I did in the book, to tell y'all what to do and you do it in your house. Like that feels happier to me because it's just like unique to each space, which gets really time consuming, right? So I want like you as the owner, as the individual, as the designer. I mean, I like that designers can steal my tricks. I like that homeowners can steal my tricks. And honestly, renters can steal my tricks. And that feels good. For me, I guess not doing other people's houses and projects is because I want everyone out of my way.
Right.
But like when you have a client, rightfully so, they want to be involved. They want to chime in. They want to know how money is being spent. Like that is all right. That is correct. But for me, what I want to do doesn't really make sense until it's done. So it's really not for the faint of heart, you know?
Yeah.
So if I like, this is why working with Grace Mitchell in Round Top, Texas, man, we are each other's best client because we're like, hey, what if we truck a shack over here? Like, yeah. And what if we paint it all beige? Yeah. And so she and I creatively and energetically raise each other up. And that's been really special and fun. And so doing it like that, I mean, if I was smart, and I'm not in form, if I was smart, I would just do a house how I want and then sell it and do it again. Right.
Yeah.
But like, I just would rather work in my ceramic studio and write a book and like talk about like deep thoughts, philosophies.
Yes. Yes. Deep thoughts. So
that's right.
So wrapping up, Leanne, where are we going to see you? Are you coming on a big old tour for this book, or what's your plan?
Dennis, take a guess if I'm going on a.
I'd be pretty surprised if that were the case, but you know,
that's right. I'm making it up as I go along on my Instagram, which is Leanne Ford Interiors. I kind of am just saying, hey, we're going to get together tomorrow. So I guess, you know, see you when I see you, everybody. But I am really very thrilled and happy to just get this book out on the planet. That feels really good to me.
Well, I love you coming out just for this, and I feel honored that you've graced me with your presence and
back at you.
I love the work. I love the book, and I'm wildly fond of you as well. So I thank you for the time, and I look forward to seeing you. You know, not soon, but one day. Right?
That's right. Well, no, Texas, you come on down.
Yes, in Round Top. I can't wait for that. All right.
Thank you for having me. This is so fun.
And we're back. We're getting to the end of the show here. But before we go, we'd like to take a second to highlight anything going on in the industry that might have caught our eye. Fred, what caught your eye?
Quince caught my eye, Dennis. At the beginning of the year, I predicted that Quince would be an incredibly meaningful company in the home industry. And I'm trying to make that come true by talking about it a lot. But no, in all sincerity, I think Quince is a bigger and bigger player in home. They roll out more new home stuff seemingly every week. And what I've noticed is that they have a new thing going where they do these pop-ups where they actually bring the product to a space where people can come in and touch it and see it, feel it, which obviously makes sense. At some point, you need to do that in home. Otherwise, people aren't going to buy your sofas. I saw that former guest of the show, Emily Henderson, went to the pop-up and did a report on it. It was interesting. I think they'll probably need to do more than this long term, but they're clearly serious about home and they're doing stuff. And I think that my prediction may just come true, Dennis. I don't know. I don't know about the Charles Cohen one, but this one is on its way.
I think you can put that Howe's prediction to bed by proving yourself right on the Quince prediction, Fred. This is exciting.
Yes. One of these days, one of my predictions is going to come true. So, what caught your eye this week, Dennis?
Stick around. One of the things that caught my eye, and I was so excited to see, Sheila Bridges, who is a collaboration machine. I never got to get my speaker with the fabulous Harlem Twal on it, but I am absolutely going to get some of the fabulous Walmart collaboration. There are plates and glasses, and it's partially a Philadelphia celebration, partially an American history celebration, and mostly is a celebration of Sheila Bridges just being available to the Walmart masses, which makes me so happy.
Walmart's going upscale. I feel like they're crawling the luxury mountain a little bit. I mean, they're not at the top, but our retail correspondent Warren Schulberg has been talking about that recently. It's interesting.
I couldn't agree more. Amex Platinum offers Walmart membership as one of its benefits. So I mean, okay. If that doesn't tell you that they're going upscale, right? Yeah. The other thing that caught my eye was a big acquisition in the home building space. I mean, it would be a big acquisition for some, but Berkshire Hathaway, who is acquiring the home builder Taylor Morrison for $6.8 billion, is only using, wait for it, less than 3% of the available cash that they have on hand right now. Yes, that's right. How would you like to be Berkshire Hathaway and have over $350 billion just sitting around going, should we buy a home builder today for $6.8 billion? Yeah, I guess so. But it's interesting because I don't think in any way that it's a call that this is the bottom in the housing market, but I do think that Berkshire Hathaway is a very savvy long-term investor. I think they see the value in this. They already own Clayton Home. They own Benjamin Moore. They own a lot of things in and around the housing space. And I think they see, you know, fine, let's buy this, ride this out. Let's take an even bigger position in it. I think it's very interesting. What'd you make of this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think like when you have that much cash in your bank, you can think very long term. And I think yeah. At some point, people are going to buy homes again. It's going to happen. It may not be in 26. It may be survived to 27, survived to 28. Not too late, but I think it's going to happen. And if you can afford to take this on and wait it out, I think you'll be well positioned. So, you know, I think it's something unique to them, but why not?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think this is one of the first acquisitions for Greg Abel, who's taking over at Berkshire Hathaway. And I think this tells us a lot about how they're thinking. All right. That's That's all the time we have today. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to keep up with the latest news, browse job listings, or take a workshop, visit us online at businessofhome.com. If you want to get in touch with the show, write to us at podcast@businessofhome.com. This episode was produced by Fred Nikolaus and Caroline Burke and edited by Michael Castaneda. I'm Dennis Scully. Have a great weekend, and we'll be back with you on Monday.